study of yoga brings us to an immediate point which requires clarification. We do not advocate that the Western person attempt the acceptance of yoga disciplines exactly as they are taught in the East. The reasons for our feelings are good and sufficient. Most of all, the basic difference in Eastern and Western psychology of living. And there is no subject in which inconsistencies can be more dangerous than in this particular type of advanced philosophic thinking. On the other hand, there are principles involved which are universal. And not only does increase of knowledge depend upon an estimation of these principles, but our entire ethical and social life must in time include a clear comprehension of the Eastern life way, without which we can never hope for a global concept of living or the final solution of East-West problems. So what we want to do primarily is to explore similarities and differences without any accusations, without any criticisms, but trying to point out those Eastern principles which are useful, necessary to the development of Western life. Most of you have some general knowledge of this subject. Therefore, we will limit our preliminary remarks as much as possible. We know that the term yoga means union, and that the yogas, variously taught and named in India, and the same principles under other names in the religious philosophies of other Near Eastern and Far Eastern peoples, that the yogas represent disciplines of union, that they represent means for man's internal re-identification with cause, with essence, with being, with reality. We also know that there is a definite difference in the Eastern and Western concepts of union. The term can be left without further examination and be meaningful to both. But as we examine more closely, we realize that the religious psychology of the East and West differ as to what constitutes the ultimate attainment by man of his spiritual fulfillment. Western man, in his so-called mystical discipline, drifts toward what may be termed contemplation. Eastern man toward meditation. These are not the same things. Contemplation, as the term generally applies to us, is a person or a being intently experiencing something in relationship to himself. To contemplate, therefore, is to bestow the faculties of self upon some object, in the effort to understand it, in the effort to a degree at least to possess it. I think that perhaps we can get something of the perspective by reference to the Canticles of Solomon. In this wonderful song, which is Solomon's, we have a document almost completely the work of some poet or mystic deep in the same spiritual conviction as we find among the Sufis. In the beginning of his love poem, and of course the Dark Maiden of Jerusalem is wisdom, is the beloved, is truth. Solomon begins with a purely Western contemplative attitude when he says, my beloved is mine. Me and mine are the pillars of the temple of Western existence. We exist as persons, as individuals. And in our concept of growth, we grow as persons and individuals. We seek to unfold personality and individuality, even going so far as to assume that the selfhood within us is the divine ultimate for us, and that by the perfect expression of self, we achieve to the release of deity through our own natures. And this contemplative attitude, then, is that of the mystical observer, who, being in the presence of great or wonderful things, examines them, contemplates them, scrutinizes them, seeks to understand them, and when measured, seeks to impose upon them the understanding which he already possesses. Thus the universe becomes for him a gradual unfoldment of his own expectancy. Seeking he finds, believing he observes the objects of belief fulfilled before him. And in his contemplative mood, he is forever justifying the convictions of his own personal consciousness. He therefore imposes himself upon the universe. He interprets the universe in terms of himself. He experiences universals in terms of personals. And we find this on every level of human thinking among Western peoples. Our Western concept of love is to desire to possess. And our Western acceptance of love is that we are possessed. I have had women come to me in very serious marital problems who complain that their great grievance against their husband was that he was not possessive enough. Now, some may not feel that way, but it does occur. They did not believe he loved them because he did not constantly seek to own or possess. And in this way, fulfill an expectancy, which is normal, common to Western peoples. Thus, in the Western extension of philosophy and mysticism, we find man reaching out toward a God of things, and a state of rulership, and a state of leadership, and a state of uniting with a power which ordains action, which causes action. Growth of man is therefore from human to superhuman estate, and from that to a divine estate, in which becoming God-like, he becomes also possessed of the attributes of deity, seeing in the fulfillment of his own nature the release of divine powers through himself. Thus we have in our Western way of life the possibility of the Superman concept, the possibility of recognizing man's infinite potential to grow, and that this growth is always toward the fulfillment of an individual or personal destiny. That man comes finally to knowledge when he understands God, that he achieves truth when he understands truth. Always he is the understanding thing, the unit of awareness, the contemplating power within him, by means of which he can assimilate or accept all knowledge and absorb it into his own nature. Thus he becomes wise, he becomes learned, he becomes skilled, he becomes informed. In the Eastern way of life, however, we have a somewhat different concept, as presented, finally, also by Solomon in his song. For at the end of the song, after he has experienced something of a more generous or deeper mystical experience within himself, Solomon now sings in a different note, and sings simply the words, I am my beloved. This is a complete change of perspective, and maybe to a degree at least, similar to the Eastern concept of meditation. Meditation is not the individual contemplating infinite. Meditation is the continuous remembrance of a divine reality. It is the individual longing not to become the God, but to return to a godlike condition superior to himself. He no longer seeks to become or to be. He no longer accepts that knowledge will come and be possessed by him. Rather, he regards these great archetypal realities as so vast, so immeasurable, so infinite and ultimate, that he is absorbed by them. Instead of possessing truth, he is possessed by truth. For it is not his own opinion or his own attitude, but the reality which is eternal, immortal, and inevitable. And to the Eastern individual, individuality is separation from reality. And therefore, the search is for re-identification with that which is infinitely beyond the state of selfhood. When we consider these differences, therefore, we realize that they become the basis of a different ethical approach to life. For there is a great deal of difference throughout the career of the individual who wishes to gain and who wishes to give. These express themselves on innumerable levels. They do not pertain entirely to a high religious problem. They are everywhere present in the conduct of our affairs. Therefore, they become a motivating factor on every level of our living. The individual who seeks to become more, or the individual who seeks to be re-identified with that which is eternally more, attaining all by giving all rather than by getting all. To live to get has produced Western civilization. To live to give, theoretically, is the fulfillment of the mystical disciplines of the East to produce what they regard as the perfect or enlightened saint. Now, we must be practical and practical, furthermore, in the natural statement that the fact that these disciplines, such as yoga, originate among Eastern people does not mean that all Easterners are yogis, nor does it mean that the Eastern world is without many of the defects from which the West suffers, and others which belong to its own life way. Therefore, the answer to the simple question, if these things are better, why are not the people better, may also be answered by our own philosophy of life and our own experience. For 1900 years, we have taught peace on earth and goodwill to men, and during that time, we have fought 8,000 wars. So that we must not assume that individuals are capable simply of exemplifying their beliefs because they would like to. There is much more that must be accomplished, both in the East and West, before either of these systems can fulfill its full purpose or reveal its complete merit. We are living in a world of imperfect beings seeking to grow. We must therefore not expect more from others than we are able to produce ourselves. This does not in any way affect the merits or demerits of either the Eastern or Western life way, but it would cause those who are impatient in either path to recognize that their own failings reveal those limitations which we have not yet the skill, wisdom, or strength to overcome. Now this evening we are beginning a study of the problem of yoga. And we are approaching it on this simple ground, that the basic principle of yoga is that through meditation, the individual is capable of experiencing a consciousness separate from his own. The principle of yoga means, primarily, that through a certain internal discipline, accompanied by a kind of attentiveness, that it is possible for the human being to have the most valuable and mysterious experience in the world, the experience of experiencing something beside himself. So this is the primary problem. Years ago at Berkeley, I discussed a problem relating to experience with a physicist there. He said, frankly, I would give half the length of my life if for 5 minutes I could change consciousness with one of the dogs here in the laboratory, so that for one moment only, I could be something beside myself. For in that moment, I would know much of the mystery of life. Would break through this inevitable and terrible barrier by which the innermost parts of all things are isolated from each other, so that we have concourse and intercourse only on the objective level, but that within ourselves we can experience nothing but ourselves, and therefore we can never escape from the pattern within our own natures. Now the whole principle of yoga rests upon the possibility of the individual escaping from himself, escaping from the peculiar imitation of his own internal genius. This mysterious thing by which, no matter what happens, it must happen to him. And no matter what happens, it must be interpreted by him according to what he is. No more, no less. So that everywhere and forever, the individual, in the presence of infinite, is bound to an interpretation based upon his own finite consciousness. He may love things, he may venerate them, he may admire them, he may worship them, and yet still, he is something apart from everything else that lives. And this apartness is probably the cause of the great psychosis which has given man the tremendous intensities which have produced the civilizations of history. Man's civilization is what it is. His arts and sciences are what they are. His industries and his economics stand in their present places simply because of one thing. The human being, in the West particularly, has never been able to experience anything except himself. Now this is the supreme isolation. It is the supreme separateness. It must be the basis of all conflict, because it relates to what Plotinus calls multitude. Multitude being the experience of separateness, the experience of self and not self, of object and subject, of being and not being, of me and thou. Experiences which we gradually accept, which become inevitable to us as the basis of personal conscious experience. Yoga assumes the possibility of the individual breaking this barrier. And of course, as an experience, it is far more important to him than breaking the sound wall or anything of that nature, because it must be the basis for him of his first experience as a universal being. And without this experience of a universal existence, he must remain a personal being. Now, philosophy, ethics, culture, morality, many systems that we already have in an advanced to a marked degree, teach us that there is an existence apart from ourselves. They teach us that art is in spirit, a moving power, an archetypal pattern, that beauty and these things have an existence. Man can venerate them from afar. The artist or maker can experience them within his own capacities and limitations. But philosophy does affirm that there is a holistic existence beyond man's present state. And mysticism has always affirmed the possibility, under some condition, of the experience of this state. And this experience, the mystical experience of Adelard Ellis, is an experience of universality, or a universal or total acceptance of life impact. Yoga seeks to achieve this, and it does not necessarily affirm that the only object of identity is being or deity. Some systems of yoga, certainly, are particularly concerned with man's experience of participation in deity. Other systems of yoga do not even postulate the existence of deity and still maintain the possibility of universal experience. There are schools of yoga which also make a point of the possibility of the individual experiencing other forms of activity, other forms of life, other creatures than himself. The experience of the blade of grass, as we find it in the Zen doctrine. The experience of the soul or heart of the loved one. The experience of identity with the child, with the animal, with the water flowing in the river. The possibility of the experience of not-self in relation to the subject or object of our attention. This possibility of the experience of not-self carries with it what to the West has long been regarded as a negative approach to life. The Westerner insists that the Eastern way of life is negative. And he uses this negative in a kind of negative way. The Easterner may insist that the Western way of life is positive, and he says positive with a slightly ironical implication. Each has failed to a degree, therefore, to sense values which perhaps should have been better understood, even as sects worshipping the same deity are not always able to get along happily together. But in our consideration of yoga, then, we must differentiate between contemplation, the individual examining something, seeking to understand it, and meditation, which is the state of the person seeking eternally to be understood rather than to understand. The state of the individual seeking the experience of that which is not himself, accepting it, rather than imposing himself as the conqueror of the unknown upon everything with which he comes in contact. A very good example, perhaps, of the Western attitude has been the fatalists, in which, for example, men like Aesop, good moralists in their time, and treasured names in our modern world. If Aesop humanizes the animal, he imposes man upon the animal. He did not originate the idea, which came from a much earlier Asiatic source. But he causes animals to have experiences like human beings. He is again following the tendency of primitive man of assuming that other creatures are like himself. Always everything is in his own likeness. Everything is something that he patterns from familiar and reasonable things, a point which caused the well-known American agnostic, Colonel Robert Ingersoll, to observe on one occasion that an honest God is the noblest work of man, that the individual is forever forming, framing, defining all of the superiors to which he was turning, and then seeking to prove that he is right. Exploring always to the justification of his own perspective. In Eastern meditation, a great point is made of refraining from such conclusions. The conclusions come at ends, not at beginnings. That we think not from conclusions, but toward them. And that experience itself is the basis of fact, not our attitude toward experience or toward living our life. In yoga, therefore, we have several systems of discipline. And we must pause for a moment to consider discipline. What is discipline? We used to think of it very largely as the school teacher calling the small boy to stand in the corner as a punishment for a misdemeanor. Discipline is correction in a certain way. But in yoga, discipline must be imposed by the individual upon himself. Self-discipline, therefore, implies or suggests the development of a character or quality strong enough to control thought, emotion, and action. Discipline is, therefore, the exercise of a purposed will over thought, emotion, and action. Discipline is the individual controlling himself. Now this in the way is opposite also to our Western way of life. Because in the West we are accustomed to the concept that discipline is imposed by others. Discipline is imposed by the laws of our nation, of our state. It is imposed by those for whom we work. It is imposed by our moral codes, our churches, our theologies, and our philosophies. It is imposed with certain degree also by necessity, by which we find it inevitably true that we must modify certain attitudes in order to survive. But discipline is something that is done to us in the West. In the East, it is something we ourselves do. It is a decision. It is a purposed attitude toward a problem. It is the individual affirming his ability and his willingness to produce or to achieve certain ends by purpose and continuous thoughtfulness. Now, discipline is not necessarily in yoga, as you might suspect by studying some of the Indian holy men and their austerities, primarily a problem of bodily punishment. It is not an extreme asceticism, nor is it accompanied by any necessary cause of pain, of suffering, or of flagellation, or any of these things which we sometimes associate with it. In fact, in the Eastern schools, the more gentle and the more natural the discipline, the more the disciple's achievement is recognized by a qualified instructor. Discipline, however, is to life the basis of progress in any particular department of endeavor. Discipline is what makes us play the piano every day in order to learn how. Discipline is what ties the musician to his instrument. Discipline is what ties the businessman to his office, the parent to his child, man to his dreams. Always discipline is the individual's conscious decision to achieve an end at the expense of something else which he regards as less valuable or important. So discipline is imposed in yoga upon the individual in order that he may strengthen resources, that he may become more and more proficient in these sciences which to the East are so essential. Now, why does the Easterner feel the importance of yoga? Why do the yoga schools have such a distinct determination to achieve a particular end? The answer is very simple in the terms of Eastern thinking. In the East, only one thing is important. I would say this again with modification. It may not be true and is not true of every Easterner. But it is true when we speak of the East as a school of thought, not as a group of persons. In the East, the school of thought, which we call yoga, insists that the supreme end of human existence is that man shall escape from error. That no matter what he attains on a material plane, he attains ends which are in themselves, not usually, as important or as valuable as the energies expended to attain them. Because everything that man does here is completely impermanent. He is forever drawing colors upon the face of water. Nothing that he does here, nothing that he learns here, can per se achieve for him any permanence, any security, any reality beyond this limited sphere in which he lives. Also, a great many of the attributes of effort with which he is associated have very little significance on the level of character. This is not inevitably true, but it is true with the thoughtless, who make no real or conscientious effort to understand even the small things that they do. Thus, the Western person, or the non-philosophic person, perhaps more correctly, is not advancing the essentials of his own life. He is advancing only things which in themselves are impermanent. So he advances in his various fortunes. He builds a business, dies and leaves it. He creates a fortune which his heirs will squander. He seeks position and honor, only to gain in the end a premature grave because of the responsibilities that he must bear. He makes various compromises constantly with realities in order to achieve unrealities. And as a result of this, he is outwardly enriched, but inwardly impoverished. As long as he is willing to accept such a code of life, there is very little that can be done about it. But in the large picture of living, can any rational or reasonable creature assume that as a citizen of the universe, he should be unmindful completely of universals as they relate to himself? It may be necessary and proper for him to make a living and advance himself in certain schools of learning and arts and sciences and trades and crafts. But can these be regarded as the full expression of his life? Can he be said to have lived well simply because he has attained a comparative security in this plane of living, only to depart therefrom into an insecurity he knows nothing about? Can he ever achieve sufficiently on a mental, emotional, or material level to be secure even here? Does the person who has achieved what this world can give him, has he achieved serenity of spirit? Has he achieved the power of self over circumstance? Has he attained an inward integration or an integrity that gives him faith with which to face change and time? Or has he very largely perfected an outward living which has no substance within it and which therefore can crumble and leave him destitute? To the Eastern philosophic mind, the only solution to every problem that exists in the world is man's experience of a universal greater than himself. If he has this experience, he can then administer all of his personal worldly affairs more wisely. If he has this experience, nations will no longer need war. There will be no longer crime. There will be no longer these excesses by means of which all of the good plans and purposes of conscientious human beings come to nothing. Thus, in a way, the Easterner restates the statement in the Bible, "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, and all else shall be added unto you." Now, in Western civilization, we have not sought it first. In fact, we have not really sought it at all, with the exception of isolated persons. Our civilization is not built upon the individual having first attained internal security. It is rather built upon the forlorn hope that if other conditions are suitable, he may ultimately attain spiritual security. It is a complete reversal of the concept upon which the whole system is based. So yoga drives directly at the source and substance of the human dilemma. It emphasizes the need of the individual for an immediate integration of his own relationships with the life around him, the world around him. It teaches him to experience those things which he needs, or invites him to such experience, and tells him that the only way in which this experience can come to him is that he must earn it. And he earns it by discipline. He earns it by the continuous demonstration of his earnest and natural desire to know, to achieve this state of being. He also achieves it by the full and complete statement of his willingness to sacrifice for it. And what a man must sacrifice in these things, again, is a little reminiscent of some of the veiled statements of the New Testament. Because what shall the man sacrifice? With what shall he pay for this treasure that is beyond value? He certainly cannot buy it with money. He has tried that and found a dismal failure. He cannot buy it or pay for it by practically any of the services that he normally renders. He cannot think his way to it. He cannot even feel his way to it. For thought and emotion are inadequate for the ultimate goal that he wishes to reach. Therefore, what has the human being to give, which is a great enough and worthy enough offering, that it may compensate for the one and eternal thing which he desires to gain? And the Eastern answer to that, perhaps better stated than I have stated it, is very simple. The only thing any individual has to give to anything is himself. And in yoga, the price of liberation is the immediate and unhesitating surrender of self. That the individual who wishes to achieve the eternal must attain that end by the complete and voluntary sacrifice of the temporal. This does not mean that he gives away his goods. It does not mean that he neglects his family. It does not mean that he takes a little flag and starts out on a crusade. Nothing of that kind at all. What it actually means is that within himself, he relinquishes the concept of I. That he relinquishes the I want, I am, I will, I can. That he relinquishes the vortex, the focal illusion of selfhood, realizing ultimately that this is the one thing that stands between him and universal. Things are either personal or universal. Self is the ultimate personal. The universal is the ultimate impersonal. And at the time of the attainment of the impersonal, the personal must die. Not killed, not surrendered regretfully because we wish we could hold on to it, grasping at both the finite and the infinite at the same time, but through a complete and internal understanding which makes this surrender of the personal not only obviously the thing which is next, but also that which is the greatest desire of our beings to achieve. The complete, glorious, happy, serene, and acceptable sacrifice of that which we now recognize or realize to be an impediment to the eternal value with which we are concerned. Now this brings us to the first subject of our major series at this moment, and that is we're going to talk a little on the theme of Kama Yoga. Now, as you know, there are many yogas, and in many books and in some writings, this term is not even included. But it seems to me that from a philosophical standpoint, it is one of the most important considerations, especially for Western man. The term kama implies the ethical consequences of conduct considered collectively or completely. In other words, karma is the inevitable relationship between what the individual is and what he does, and also between what he does and what he is. Karma is, therefore, the totality of action in its relation to its ethical and moral, its spiritual, its intellectual, and its physical consequences. Buddha, in one of his dialogues, says that effect follows cause as the wheel of the car follows the foot of the oxen. Man lives in a world of cause and effect. He lives in a world in which, as far as his own present consciousness is concerned, there is an intimate relationship between his own incentives and their results. So in the study of yoga, we can conceive, for example, man achieving a state of meditation, as this may relate to his own conduct. It is the problem of the introduction of a discipline into the concept of conduct, and strangely enough, is one of the very foundations of Raja Yoga, which is probably the highest form of the royal discipline of this system. the Arabian Nights entertainment contains the famous line, happiness must be earned. Raja Yoga is a princely state of consciousness which must be earned. Therefore, we come right back to karma, because karma is the law of earning. It is the principle in nature of the relation between sowing and reaping. If the end of man's journey is absolute identification with reality, then this end must be earned. It must be the result of action. It must be the consequence of things preceding it, or previously done and attained. Thus, daily conduct becomes, in the end, the royal road of union. Daily conduct may seem to be so simple, non-mystical in its implications, as to be overlooked. The individual would like to step over these little problems of his own disposition and dash on to the contemplation of infinites. It's much more simple and much more delightful to be engaged in some advanced mystical preoccupation than it is to start with a simple study and estimation of conduct. Yet where else can we begin but where we are? And where are we except in the place of our conduct? That which we are tells our present place in nature, our present place in the universe, and the rung of the ladder of infinites upon which we are at the moment standing. So karma yoga implies the thoughtful acceptance of the law and the doctrine through the patient observation of conduct. Through the recognition of the relationship of immediate conduct to universals, of the quiet meditation of the individual upon those great laws of eternal being, which are exemplified in conduct. Now, yoga depends also upon one very important point. Now, that point is a stranger to us in the West. And that point is internal quietude. With the exception of a few sects, such as the Quakers, the Friends of the Quietists, we have had very little emphasis upon the attainment of quietude, as we consider it in Eastern discipline. Quietude is the condition in which the individual, relaxing, ceasing aggressive action of any kind, finds within himself peace. Now this is a large order for Western man, because the moment we begin to probe into ourselves in the West, we are apt to run across a number of psychotic pressures. We are likely to find, as many human beings in the Occident have found, that the last person we can get along with well is ourselves. Therefore, that it is much more pleasurable and enjoyable to spend our time in the association of others, even though we do not believe what they say or agree with what they do. They have one virtue: they keep our mind off of ourselves. Therefore, we have all kinds of avocational interests. We whittle and we doodle anything so that we shall not fall into the abysmal misery of internal confusion. We are escapists. We move desperately away from self because we are not able to endure its immediate implication to us in our nature. Thus, we are without quietude. We are without quietude because we are without faith. We are without faith because we are without internal certainties. And these we lack because we have never developed them, being content entirely to rest our case upon external securities of one kind or another. So the individual, seeking quietude within himself, finds what? He finds that he has not this quietude, and for one reason primarily, because he is ignorant. The reason why he is not able to get along in the universe is because he misunderstands the universe, or does not understand it. His ignorance is either the simple ignorance of the child or the compound ignorance of the sophist, one or the other. But had he not ignorance, he would not have fear, for fear and ignorance are related. Only the ignorant can be afraid, and the fearful must be ignorant. Because there is nothing in the universe that can cause fear except man's own ignorance of realities. If, therefore, we seek at the beginning of things to retire into a state of security and are seeking ignorance within our own natures, we can only achieve this end if we have a reasonable attitude toward infinite. If we have the belief that the infinite is a strange, half-good, half-evil thing, combining God and demon, if we believe that the unknown is malicious, if we believe that the universal power is either unhonest or dishonest, we can scarcely have the type of internal integration suitable for internal peace. So, in Karma Yoga, we have a very important state of consciousness to cultivate. And that is the continuous recollection of the integrity of reality. Now, that sounds like perhaps a platitude, and it is, as long as it is on the tongue or merely in the mind. But only through a certain knowledge or a certain interpretive skill can we gradually put the universe back on an honest foundation as far as we are concerned as individuals. And an honest universe must be the beginning of our own true concept of honesty. So by means of the recognition of law, we begin the process of rescuing values from the obscuration of multitude, from the confusion due to our own inability to estimate the principles upon which our own existence depends. Recognizing this principle, then, we begin through the contemplation of karma. And the first thing that karma must teach us, and the first contemplation or meditation that we may have concerning it, for we are still on the contemplated level, we are still at this stage of the problem, fighting to save God from our own misinterpretation of deity, which is quite an arduous undertaking, by the way. Thus, we begin by understanding that we live in a universe of law. Now, this, to most people, is a very inhibiting discovery. Because one thing that we have all a strange resistance to is guidance, domination, or authority. Our search for freedom seems to make us feel that the moment that we come under any pattern of authority, we should be frustrated. And yet, law is not a frustrating thing. Law, the existence of law, is the greatest good thing that we know. The law, intellectually, thinks of lawyers and judges and jurors and things of that nature. It's a very cold, it's a very hard term. It sounds very much like a 90-day sentence or $500 bail. Law, to us, is something administered by men, based upon the codes of Justinian and Hammurabi. Law to us is a mental word. It is a word that carries exactitude, harmless, soulless, and without understanding. The jot and tittle, the eye for the eye and the tooth for the tooth. Therefore, we have to begin to use our contemplating power, our meditation, and in the continuous remembrance of what law is. And to experience law, not as an institution created by man, or an arbitrary dictate set up by the tyranny of a divine will, but that law is reality. Law is being. Law is actuality. Law is the greatest comfort, the greatest security, the infinite fact of things. Law is our hope, not our Chela. And law is not a continuous exertion of will. Law is the eternal unfoldment of universal love itself. Therefore, law and love are the same thing. They are not polarities. And why must we say that? We say it because law and love work together and unite in the service of good. That which is the law is the greater good. That which is the greater good is the greater love. Now we find this, for example, in a very simple way in our own human problem. We do not like to tell a small child that it shouldn't have that ice cream cone. We want that child to be happy. But as parents, perhaps we must say no, the child is aggrieved, and for the moment we are equivalent to the universal tyrant itself. And yet, it is our love and not our tyranny that has caused the action. It is our greater knowledge of a greater good. Therefore, in the mystical concept of things, law is not merely an arbitrary pattern. It is the eternal good itself. It is that which has within it, by its own intrinsic nature, all of love, all of good, and all of reality. Laws, then, are not to be feared, but to be loved, to be understood, to be appreciated, to be sensed for their real and enduring value. For man's most immediate contact with the creating power is through law. Even science knows this, because it is the exactitude of the universe that causes the greatest admiration on the part of the scientist. And it is that exactitude which causes him to suspect the presence of the lawmaker, the presence of the reality behind things. So we begin with the concept of this continual meditation, this flowing of consciousness, add oil from one vessel to another, moving on the concept of law, moving on the realization that that which occurs is not only necessary but good. That universal law as it operates upon man is not the will of an arbitrary deity, but the eternal expression of the eternal being. That law is innate in being. That the supreme is law. And that also that the law is the manifestation of that which is supreme. That this supreme is infinite benevolence, infinite beauty, infinite truth. The most perfect forms in the world, like snowflakes, are themselves perfect manifestations of the great law. Plato said, God geometrizes. Moral laws are moral geometry. Ethical laws are ethical geometry. And if we could see these laws transformed from their tremendous pressure foci as we realize their impact upon ourselves, if we could see the pictures of the laws of the universe, we would see the greatest art the world has ever known. We would see the art of the creating power itself, infinitely unfolding in absolute symmetry. Why then do laws seem so difficult to us? Largely because we have placed against these laws that which to the Asiatic mystic is the greatest danger. And that is a self-focal point, the ego. A point of will which does not understand. A point of will, therefore, which is like that of a small child who is forbidden the ice cream cone and does not know why. And because this little child cannot experience the consciousness of a parent, it will never be able, until it grows itself and experiences, it will never be able to understand why it could not have the ice cream cone. So in the problem of selfhood, or the focal point of I want what I want, man comes into conflict with a universal pattern which alone knows what he needs. And it is the recognition of the absolute benevolence of the universe
that must lie at the beginning of the gradual rescuing of the human consciousness from tension. Because tension arises from confusion, it arises from stress, it arises from rebellion, it arises from all these illusionary attitudes of reproach, of disagreement, of disillusionment, of conflict between individuals and between all individuals and the patterns which are eternally good for them. So karma begins to unfold on a level of conduct, a simple and approachable level. The importance of the human being's recognition of the essential rightness of that which occurs to him. The essential and inevitable rightness of the position and condition in which he is placed. It begins to emphasize to him rightness rather than wrongness. It makes the thoughtful, careful, considerate person no longer able to say, why did this happen to me? Why should I suffer for the sins of another? Why should I be the victim of the generation in which I live, the circumstances in which I find myself, the inharmonies with which I am surrounded and burdened? While the individual turns to the universe and says why, he is indeed of little faith. But through the contemplation of law, a man begins to answer his own why. There gradually emerges to his comprehension this magnificent unfolding blossom of realities, and the universal pattern becomes to him the hope of his own future, because it is only through law that his own inevitable attainment is assured. And were there in the universe any dishonesties such as there are among men, then the fate of the human being could not be secure. If the laws of the universe could be bribed, could be in any way influenced by human will or purpose, then some would succeed and others fail, and not always would the meritorious attain. But in the absolute honesty of the universe is the hope of the individual that he lives within a universal environment which is incorruptible, and therefore the greatest good for himself. Now this means that the individual in Eastern thinking must accept the situation in which he finds himself as a discipline. That instead of being expected to go out and sit on a bed of spikes, he must come home and sit among his creditors, which perhaps is just as painful and certainly less glamorous. That instead of being expected to go out and give his goods to the poor, or expected to make a pilgrimage to some sacred shrine, it is impressed upon him through his daily conduct that he must do those things and perform those actions which expiate the responsibilities and debts which he has incurred. He learns in various ways, and some of the simplest lessons are immediate. Some not so simple are extended over larger periods of time. Many persons say that because of circumstances which they cannot grasp, it is impossible for them